Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Slow growth, a sluggish jobs turnaround, stalled financial regulation, fears of giant public debt. America's economy begins 2010 in what can look like a kind of suspended animation with many questions. Will the recovery be jobless? Will Wall Street stymie reform? Where do I put my money? And is another crisis hiding in plain sight? Today we'll talk with big picture economist Simon Johnson about where we stand. He sees growth and trouble. This hour on Point, Simon Johnson on the U.S. economy. Joining me now is Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, now professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. His widely read blog is baselinescenario.com. His forthcoming book is 13 Bankers. Simon Johnson, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tom.
You're just back from Atlanta and the American Economics Association conference there. What's the mood? What's your mood?
The mood at the American Economic Association conference, the AEA, as they call it, was mixed in a very interesting way. A lot of people, most of the, I would say, serious people who work on banking issues and finance issues, feel very negative about the structure of incentives for our big banks. They feel that these banks have become too big to fail and nobody is dealing with that problem. That's a huge sword hanging over our economy. On the other hand, many people see a recovery coming. They see jobs coming back. They feel somewhat relieved. And I would say most of my colleagues are somewhat inclined to be, I think, rather overly nice towards Mr. Ben Bernanke.
So let's look at the kind of good news part of that first, if we can. They see growth. They see recovery, turnaround.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the standard features of a broad, diverse, big economy like the United States is when it goes down, it can go down quite sharply, but it also bounces back. I think the optimists, for example, Mike Musa, who's one of my colleagues at the Peterson Institute in Washington, is calling for a 5% growth in 2010 based on sort of historical experience. Consensus is more like 3% growth. I think my view is somewhere between the two. The consensus is a little bit on the low side. But there's lots of problems remaining around consumers, around cars, around housing that mean that Mike Musa's forecast is unlikely, to come through fully.
If you have 5% growth or even if you have 3% growth, first of all, what does that mean? What might that mean for jobs and job creation and unemployment, Simon?
Well, that's the huge question, Tom. We have experienced in the past a variety of relationships between output coming back, between the growth part and employment coming back. Obviously, unemployment will come down to some degree. But what people are worried about, a lot of the labor economists, for example, and people who really drill down into the details here, think we're going to have what's so-called jobless recovery. It's not entirely jobless, but it's not a lot of jobs being created relative to the recovery in output. And that means the unemployment rate is going to come down, probably start to come down in a way that people will feel and feel better about in the second quarter of 2010. But it's going to come down slowly, and it's going to take a really long time to get back to the unemployment rate that we had before the crisis, say go back to 2007. And some people, even optimistic people, are saying we may never get back down to unemployment back down below 5%.
You've called, if there's a recovery, you're calling it a finance-led recovery or financial-led recovery. What do you mean by that?
Well, basically, Tom, what happened last year is the government, the Obama administration, put big unconditional guarantees behind the largest financial institutions. So if you're under $100 billion in total assets, you can fail, you can go bankrupt. That's actually what happened to CIT Group last year. But if you're bigger than that, if you're the size of a Goldman Sachs, about $800 billion, plus or minus, depending on the day, or JP Morgan Chase, which is even bigger, or Citigroup, which is big and hugely troubled, you cannot fail. That's what the administration signaled with the stress test. That's what they signaled with all kinds of support provided, particularly through the Federal Reserve by Ben Bernanke. And the financial markets like that. Of course they like that. Big means you can pile it. The big stocks are safe, and you can pile in there. But we know from a long, about 400 years of financial modern financial history, that this kind of incentive incentive structure for the financial system, it leads to trouble. Ken Rogoff, who's at Harvard, Carmen Reinhart, who's at Maryland, have a fantastic book reviewing all of this kind of financial history, hundreds of years. My reading of their evidence is that this is what leads to big, serious trouble.
Big, serious trouble in what kind of time frame? We'll talk about how it might unfold, but you're talking about a recovery in this year. People are accustomed to, I don't know, every quarter century or so, a crisis. We kind of just very painfully live with that. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, no, it's not. The timing is, of course, the hardest, really hard thing to predict here. The kinds of crisis that we're thinking about are not once every 75 years or every 25 years. If you look at international financial crises, it's about once every 3, 4, maybe 5 years around the world over the past 20 years. Now, we haven't had one with this kind of severity centered on the United States for a while, mm-hmm. But we have had crises. We used to call these emerging market crises. I think one lesson from the last 2 years that we really must learn is the U.S. is not that different from emerging markets like Brazil, Russia, Korea, Argentina. Not as different as we'd like to be, not as different as we thought we would be. We're just as exposed to this kind of financial sector-led panic and crisis of confidence. Actually, the U.S. was very much prone to these kinds of crises before the 1930s. We had a lot of these in the 19th century, and we obviously had some huge ones in the early 20th century. We didn't have them during the period of relatively tight, effective financial regulation from the 1930s to the 1980s. But when the financial sector escaped those regulations in and after the Reagan Revolution, and of course during the Clinton administration also, that's when the world financial market started to go haywire in a way that really affected economies and jobs and regular people in terrible, terrible ways.
And now you're writing that we're headed for recovery, may even be called in certain dimensions a boom. You say the boom will be pleasant while it lasts. It might go on for a number of years in much the same way people enjoyed the 1920s. Great. Then you write, the most worrisome part is we're nearing the end of our fiscal and monetary ability to bail out the system. We're becoming more vulnerable to disaster on an epic scale. So is that really? I mean, we're headed for something, you think, bigger than what we've just seen, what we saw, I don't know, in the 30s?
Well, I think we're heading for something bigger than what we've seen, definitely bigger than what we've just seen. What we saw now was a wake-up call. We were lucky that enough fiscal stimulus was available. Perhaps it should have been bigger, but it was roughly the right size and doable. And we were lucky that the Fed was able to cut interest rates and do what they call quantitative easing, put mm-hmm. money into the economy, basically. But there's no guarantee that the size of financial shock that you will face in the future will be matched by the ability of the government to respond, either for political reasons or economic reasons. We got lucky, Tom, really lucky in that sense. I'm calling it, I think what we went through, we should call it the great catastrophe or the great wake-up call. But the situation of 1929, 1931 is one in which you don't have an ability to respond, to match the crisis, the panic, the downturn that comes from the financial sector. You can't match that with a policy response. And I think it would be very unwise going forward to assume the policy response will always be there. Now, I don't think you don't get exactly a rerun of the 1930s. We have a much larger government sector now. Government sector doesn't crater the way the private sector does when credit completely dries up. So you don't, I think, go down as far as you go down in the 1930s, but you can have a really awful period of depression, effectively. And if you don't believe me, go to Japan and look at the data and look at what happened in the past 20 years in Japan, because they ran a massive bubble. They let the financial sector get out of control, and then they couldn't put enough policy on the table to counteract that for various reasons.
When you say we wouldn't have a policy response next time, does that mean we just couldn't afford to do again what we've just done?
So there's a number of possibilities. One of them would be exactly that we feel that government debt is too high to be able to do a big fiscal stimulus. We started this crisis with a net government debt held by the private sector around 40% of GDP, 40% of our total economy. That's a moderate debt burden by modern standards. We are going to end this crisis. This is my personal estimate, but this is where also most of the official numbers are heading, with a debt to GDP burden of around 80%. So we'll double our debt. Wow. Just from this one crisis. Now, if we start the next one with 80%, or if the deficits continue for a number of years and we start with, say, 100% of GDP, then we're in the situation that Greece faces today, for example, or Ireland is facing, or other even more troubled places have faced in the past, that's a very difficult place in which to you try to deal with a financial panic. You can't do as much fiscal stimulus when you already have that much debt.
If you could sit knee to knee with Ben Bernanke, do you think he'd agree with your assessment of what might be available to him or a successor of his next time?
That's a great question. I am still waiting for his phone call. I'd love to chat with him about that. You know, Bernanke, among other things, is a brilliant scholar and who's written some of the very best work on the 1930s. And his view, his take on the 1930s is that the policy response from 1929, or maybe from 1930, because some of the initial Fed reaction, I think he would agree, was fairly good. But from 1930, the Fed didn't have the tools and didn't have the ideas to be able to deal with the crisis. And the question I'd like to ask him is, you know, Ben, how come? And I think this time around, you know, in the rescue phase of what happened, Bernanke did a great job as a rescuer of the financial system. Okay, give him once the panic started. But I'd like to say to him, you know, Ben, how confident are you that next time, when the financial shock could be bigger, could be more complex, could be structured differently across the world, how confident are you that we will not find ourselves in the 1930-31 situation where the people who control the money supply, the Federal Reserve and all its allies around the world, you know, have to respond? Are you really sure that we will have the means to do it? Because we've already cut interest rates down to zero. We're already pushed the frontier in incredible ways and very unpredictable ways in terms of so-called quantitative easing, putting the money, more money into the economy. How sure are you, Ben, that next time we'll be able to respond effectively and prevent a great shock from becoming a huge depression?
Get a call right here, Austin, Texas. John, you're on the air with Simon Johnson.
Hi.
Hi.
Even before Obama was nominated as a presidential candidate, I was writing on this show's forum that the economic mess was so bad it was likely to get a lot worse and be with us for years. I'd like to ask the guest if he believes that there's anything Obama could have done to change the trajectory significantly of job loss and economic recession.
Or perhaps improve the trajectory of job recovery now. Simon Johnson.
Yes, I think there's a lot that the administration could have done when they came in. You know, there was a saying that Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff in the White House, and also Larry Summers, who's the head economic guru and heads the National Economic Council, there was a saying they were using right at the beginning of the administration, never let a crisis go to waste. Well, the crisis is substantially over. The crisis phase is over, and they wasted it, as far as I can see, with regards to dealing with the financial sector, dealing with the too big to fail problem of these massive banks that feel that they can take a lot of risk and get away with it, irrespective of what happens. That problem is actually worse as a result of what this administration has done. It has not in any way been addressed by them.
I want to look at that, but let me ask you, kind of in line with John's question about employment, if something more had been done on the regulatory side, let's say, or some other way of handling the banks, would it have made a difference on unemployment? Americans care about another bust, but a lot of people care right now about another job. Would what you're so focused on have made a difference on the employment front?
Yes, it would have made a difference. It makes a difference over a period of time. And remember that the big job losses, we've lost, you know, at least 8 million jobs. When we see the latest revisions of the data from the Labor Department, 8 million jobs have gone since December 2007. That's because of a financial panic, because of the way we structured our financial industry. Now, it's true that dealing with finance and being tough on it doesn't necessarily get those jobs back quicker, but it does prevent another massive crisis. And it's the crises every 5 years or every 10 years that causes this huge disruption to people's lives and ruins millions of people's opportunities. So, you know, the point of dealing with – the point always is in other countries, the U.S. always insists actually that you deal with the underlying financial sector problems at the moment of crisis. Don't wait.
Larry Summers insisted on that with South Korea and you name it when he was Treasury Secretary under Clinton.
Exactly. And you know, that some of the things that the U.S. Treasury insisted on in those 97, 98 crises in Korea and other countries, some of those things were controversial. Some of them they probably regret. But the core idea, which Larry Summers wrote up in a brilliant lecture to the American Economic Association in January 2000, the core idea is don't base your financial system on unconditional bailouts. Okay, that's pretty unobjectionable, but of course that's not what we've done. And when you have a crisis that's based on massively distorted incentives and powerful people taking on too much risk, you've got to fix that underlying problem at the moment, at the point of impact, at the moment of crisis, because you won't get a chance to do it again before the next crisis. That's a core insight that the U.S. Treasury guys had in 97, 98. It's the same people. It's Larry Summers. It's Tim Geithner. It's David Lipton. These were the people on the ground. These are the people. And they supported a lot of sensible reformers, for example, in Korea, who were pushing for the same thing, by the way. But they couldn't do it for the United States when they had the opportunity.
We're going to dig in more on that, I promise. One more call right here, Shelbyville, Tennessee. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling. I'm in the poultry industry, and what's happened in our industry is we've had this competition game between the major players, and none of the antitrust laws that protect the suppliers to that, and this is the same model that Walmart has, none of those suppliers are being protected with our antitrust laws, so that all of the profits that are in these type of industries are grabbed by these big players, and basically all of those profits in that profit stream gets shown on Wall Street and not on Main Street, where the people who are working in those industries should be getting, you know, their part of the economy. So we have this market power forcing this deflationary cycle, you know, in all of these different kinds of industries, and in mine in particular, and weeding out competition so that later there'll be less competition and the prices will rise. So, you know, we're setting ourselves up for a really bad economic situation where we can't recover.
Tom, I think we hear some of that poultry right there. We definitely hear your concern. Simon Johnson, what do you say to Tom?
Well, I think this is a very important point. Of course, it's a broader point that our antitrust laws have not been applied well, or perhaps at all, over the past 8 years. And this needs to be addressed. And Tom is, of course, right to draw the connection between how you apply antitrust and what happens at the overall macroeconomic level. In fact, if you go back 100 years, to the beginning, to the antitrust movement and to the ideas of the progressives and the ideas that were taken up, of course, by Teddy Roosevelt most effectively at the very beginning of the 20th century. The idea here was that you have to go against big, powerful industrial and financial trusts to break their power for the point of view of society and point of view of overall growth and to help small business. So there's a big distinction, which I'm afraid the Democrats have totally missed the opportunity to play, that if you take on big business, you're helping small business, you're helping job creation. This is what, of course, Roosevelt and Louis Brandeis and Woodrow Wilson grasped. But the Democrats, I'm afraid, have lost that part of the plot.
Tom is focused on concentrated market power in the poultry industry. You focus on Wall Street, as he ultimately does there. I'm looking here at the page one of your PowerPoint presentation in Atlanta to the American Economic Association there. Crisis solves nothing. Surviving oligarchs stronger. You mean banks?
Yes. Well, the particular problem, the most knotty, difficult, and dangerous problem we face is the biggest banks. It's the largest six banks, which have become bigger since the crisis, by the way. They were helped, obviously, by all the bailout measures that were provided to them, and they've become much bigger over the past 15, 20 years. I mean, they're at a dangerous size, as we learned. There are other issues of market power, other issues of abuse of market power around the U.S. economy, including in various non-financial activities. But the real heart of what endangers growth and jobs going forward is the structure and the incentives of so-called too-big-to-fail institutions in the financial sector.
And you described for the economists in Atlanta what you called, instead of a kind of regulatory capture, I guess, to rein in American finance, instead you said, I'm looking here again at your PowerPoint, a kind of state capture, where I guess what you mean is instead of the banks being brought, under control, it's Washington that's been captured.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's been a form of ideological capture. It's not a coup like in less developed countries, and it's not explicit corruption where you pay money to people directly, although, of course, campaign contributions do play a role. I think it's the idea that unfettered finance is good, more unfettered finance is better, and crazy massive banks that are so big that if they fail, they endanger the world economy are just fine. I mean, that's to my mind and to the mind of most economists I know, irresponsible, bad economics, bad, terrible politics. But that is what most of the key policy people in Washington appear to believe.
So the question in Washington now seems to be, in part, what's going to happen with regulation, with stronger regulation. Senator Christie of Connecticut says he's on his way out. People are saying, well, maybe that means, he doesn't have to raise campaign funds from Wall Street anymore. Maybe he'll lead an aggressive regulatory push that will change the dynamic you're talking about. What do you see?
Yeah, I think that is unfortunately very, very unlikely. I think his departure from the Senate, his announcement, means that regulatory reform is all effective regulatory reform is all but dead. I mean, think of it this way: there's 40 votes against reining in the power of the financial sector. That's pretty obvious. So all the Republicans have to do is peel off one or two votes, Joe Lieberman, for example, or Dodd himself is very much inclined to compromise. And let's remember where former chairs of the Senate Banking Committee have ended up. Phil Graham, of course, is on the board of UBS. I know nothing at all about Senator Dodd's intentions and aspirations in this regard. But I'm afraid we should not expect effective regulation to come out of this process.
So is regulation what you're really looking for anyway? Or did you want the banks, some of those very big banks, to be broken up, to fail? Or is it tied up with regulation? Is it the same? Could it be the same thing?
Well, Louis Brandeis, who was a central figure in progressive thinking and sensible thinking, actually, 100 years ago, wrote a fantastic piece in 1911 in Harper's Weekly called Our Financial Oligarchy. It really nailed the problem. His line, and this is the line that was debated very hotly in the 1912 presidential election, was don't try and regulate monopoly, regulate the market. In other words, don't leave these massive firms in place and assume you can put rules on them and keep ahead of them. That is not going to work. You need to break them up. You need to put size caps on them of various forms. And obviously, we have to do something different from what was relevant in 1911, 1912. But you have to break up the big guys one way or another. And then you need to have effective regulation on that marketplace with smaller players with a lot more dispersed power structure.
Tony in Des Moines, Iowa. Tony, you're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Johnston, if we were to find the resolve to reestablish the Glass-Steagall barrier between commercial and investment banks, do you see a benefit to this? And to follow up on that, is the United States signatory to international trade agreements that preempt efforts by national legislatures to regulate their financial sector? Thank you.
Simon Johnson.
So the second part of the question is easy. There are no international trade agreements that prevent us from regulating finance effectively. In fact, we have a responsibility and a leadership role within the G20 to really make this effective. And unfortunately, we're not doing a good job on that. The Glass-Steagall question is really very interesting. And the person to watch carefully on this is Paul Volcker. Of course, Volcker has come out very strongly against the existing financial structure and attempts to regulate it. This is striking because he is officially an advisor to President Obama, and nobody has the kind of credibility and experience that Paul Volcker has, not even close. Now, what Volcker is saying is we need a form of Glass-Steagall, and basically not to go back to what we had before exactly, but the core notion is you should split what we can call casino banks that are basically gambling in financial markets, from utility banks or boring banks. Now, the boring banks is where you put your checking account. They do the payments transactions. They would not get to go off and make huge speculative bets. It's a nice, safe earner. This is what we had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in the U.S., for example. Casino banks can take risk, but they need to be a lot smaller, and they need to have a lot more capital than they do now, so that most of the losses, when they get massive losses, are borne by their shareholders, not by the system. And I think that conceptual distinction he's making is very important, and it's completely consistent with the point that we've been pushing for some time, which is put a hard size cap on the banks. The size cap can be different for casino banks and boring banks. Put a hard size cap on. Banks can choose which kind of banks they want to be. For a bank like Goldman Sachs, I would say roughly you'd have to break it up. It'd have to break itself up into about 10 pieces. That's completely doable. This is returning the size of our biggest banks to where they were roughly in 1994, 1995, when they functioned just fine. Since then, they've grown a lot bigger. No one can show you the benefits of that. And the costs are the 8 million jobs we've lost since December 2007.
I'm looking at Paul Volcker quoted here saying, we have not come anywhere close to responding with necessary vigor to the crisis that we faced. Why is that, Simon Johnson? You told us at one point last year that, you know, we had a kind of banana republic problem in this country. You're using the word oligarchs right on your right on the front page of your address to the Economists Association. Why haven't we taken advantage of this crisis as Rahm Emanuel suggested the country should?
Well, that of course is a huge question, and you need to get Rahm Emanuel on your show to ask him that directly. My take is that the degree of intellectual capture, the degree to which finance persuaded people all across the mainstream in America that it was good, it was safe, it was improving productivity and improving, providing financial innovation. You know, this capture was very deep. It went on for a long time, and it's hard to break it. I think we see some cracks appearing in Volcker's statements reflect that. Thomas Hoenig, who's president of the Kansas City Fed, is probably the serving Fed official who really gets this and has articulated this clearly. He had a great statement also in Atlanta earlier this week along these lines. So basically, it's a form of oligarchy, but it's an intellectual oligarchy. It's a cultural oligarchy. It works not through intimidating people, but by persuading people that this is in everyone's interest. And it turns out to be wrong. It turns out that it was a massive hoax, actually. And we really have to debunk that and detoxify our economy and our thinking. And it's going to be quite a struggle.
But is it really just intellectual capture? I mean, I'm looking here at a Business Week story on it saying, you know, Republicans and Democrats are in Wall Street's pocket now. They're talking particularly looking at the new Democrat coalition, sort of 68. These are fiscally conservative, sort of pro-business Democrats. They fill 15 of the party's 42 seats in the House Financial Services Committee. In the 08 election cycle, the finance industry donated almost $25 million to new Democrats. That's a lot of money. That surely buys more than just intellectual bandwidth.
It does. You're right. But I think of that as kind of the tactical weapons that they use when they want to work on specific details and lobby for various kinds of loopholes. And some of the loopholes that they get are obviously quite extraordinary. Then campaign contributions are good. They get you the right kind of access. But behind that, the broader strategic weaponry is really based on ideology and on persuading people that, you know, of course finance is good. Of course, unfettered, over-the-counter derivatives trading is healthy for the economy. All thinking people agree. That's in quotation marks. I don't agree. And I think the evidence is very strongly against that. But that ideological control is huge in Washington and around the country, I have to say. And it has to be confronted and it has to be rebutted.
I guess I still don't quite understand that. It's hard to – I don't think people do believe that anymore. And yet it's sort of the shibboleth that stands there. But we saw the evidence of the problem with that at the end of 08. We saw it. We're suffering from it still. I mean, do people really – is that ideology really dominant, or is it just powerful? Is it powerful backed up by a lot of cash?
I think it's still dominant, but it's cracking. You're absolutely right. And I would draw another historical parallel. We'll go back to 1900. 1900, very, very few mainstream people would have thought that big industrial trusts were dangerous. And if they did think they were dangerous for society, they didn't think you could do anything about it. And it really took the leadership of Teddy Roosevelt. 1902, he took Northern Securities to the Supreme Court for violating antitrust laws. Northern Securities was backed by J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan came to see Roosevelt and said to him one-on-one, you know, what's the problem here? Send your man to see my man and we'll fix it up.
Mm.
And Roosevelt said, no, we're going to the Supreme Court. And they did. And Roosevelt won. And that helped to change opinion. By 1910, 1911, everyone agreed that Standard Oil had to be broken up. It was broken up into 35 companies, Tom. And that was a good thing for America, for American jobs, American growth.
Marcia's calling from Plainfield, Connecticut. Hi, Marcia. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm very curious to know if you think there could still be billions of dollars worth of toxic assets being carried as assets on the balance sheets of these corporations that will eventually wash out to the detriment of the pension funds and charities who think they have substantial investments.
Simon Johnson.
Yes, is the answer. We know that the toxic assets are still there. We know that the government schemes that were put in place in 2009 to take those assets off the bank's balance sheets have not succeeded. Somewhere between $10-20 billion perhaps have moved out of hundreds, at least hundreds of billions of dollars that are still there. Now, the banks don't have an incentive to clean out their balance sheets because they feel they're too big to fail. They have a government guarantee implicitly and effectively. So why would they? They're waiting for prices to come back and they're hoping that things will go well. And if they go well enough, they'll, of course, make money as these securities bounce back. I'm not that optimistic about the bounce back in real estate home prices and in commercial real estate. But we'll see how that goes. And, of course, if it goes well, the banks and their executives will pay themselves. They'll pay a lot of money to themselves and to their people, big bonuses. If it goes badly, they'll hand that one over to the taxpayer also. That's the game we're in.
The game we're in because they've got the too-big-to-fail kind of sense of guarantee from the federal government. Alan, New London, New Hampshire. Alan, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. My question is this. Well, I feel like I'm sitting around watching various officials, public and private, basically not do anything to prevent the kind of situation that your guest is speaking to. And I'm wondering if there's anything that individual citizens ought to be doing. I mean, right now I feel like I'm on board the Titanic and the iceberg's coming. What am I supposed to do as an individual? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you, Alan. Simon?
Well, that's a great question, of course. And I think that first and foremost, you have to insist to your elected representatives at all levels that too big to fail is too big to exist. And there are people in the Senate and in the House who get this and who are pushing this. There are some people on the left and some people on the right, actually. So I'm not saying you have to choose left or right. I'm saying find the people with your overall political persuasion and get on their side and push them to do more and help strengthen them. I think there's also a very interesting new grassroots movement afoot where people are looking hard at their interactions, their transactions with these too-big-to-fail financial institutions, be it bank accounts or credit cards or anything else you do that generates fees and money for those people. And many people are starting to decide for themselves, and this is a very personal decision, that they'd rather move their transactions to a credit union or to a small savings bank, which has FDIC backing, of course, mm-hmm. and which it offers a better deal to customers and doesn't talk about ripping the faces off customers, which is the incredibly abhorrent language that you hear among these very big banks. People are waking up to the fact that they've been mistreated for a long time in fairly non-transparent ways by banks, by big banks, and they are starting to move their money. And I think that's an important thing for everyone to reflect on personally.
But, you know, you hear Alan saying he feels like he's sitting on the Titanic here. That's not a feeling that people should have in a democracy. I mean, I'm reading here, this is Congressman Brad Miller, Democrat, North Carolina. He's on the House Financial Services Committee. Telling Business Week, he says, my greatest fear for the last year has been an economic collapse. He says, my second greatest fear was that the economy would stabilize and the financial industry would have the clout to defeat the fundamental reforms our nation desperately needs. My greatest fear seems less likely. My second greatest fear, that is defeating reform, seems more likely every day. And I still don't get if that's just an ideological power, intellectual power that does that. It's hard to believe after the evidence we've seen. I'm sorry to be a broken record on that, Simon, but I still don't understand the strength of that rock in the road.
Well, you should have Brad Miller on your show. He's one of the most perceptive people on Capitol Hill. He's right in the middle of things. He's on House Financial Services Committee, and I'm sure he can take you through it blow by blow. Mm-hmm. I follow these things closely. I live in Washington. I interact with a lot of people on Capitol Hill, and I think a lot of it is about ideas. It's about the power of ideas. And basically, Tom, if you look at what changed between 1900 and 1910, in 1900, reasonable people thought that massive businesses, private businesses, and big industrial trusts were just fine for the overall economy, and trying to break them up would damage jobs. Okay. Mm-hmm. By 1910, no reasonable person thought that. No reasonable person believed that Standard Oil, with its market power and its abuses that had been really very well documented by Ida Tarbell and other people, nobody thought that was a good thing. And getting elected saying we must have Standard Oil run just like it has always run, that was not a winning proposition. That's what has to change. The consensus has to move. Now, that's a fight for ideas, Tom. And when
the
ideas change...
Is that a press failure, a media failure, a political failure? Is it a failure in the White House? Or does the White House... Does Larry Summers just not believe that you're right? He's the chief economic advisor here to President Obama. Does he believe that we should have banks that can appear to be too big to fail?
I don't know what Larry really believes. You have to have him on the show, too. I've read all his writings on this subject. I follow his speeches very, very carefully. And certainly what he was on the record as saying with regard to the 1990s is that too big to fail in other countries is too big to exist. Now, why he and his colleagues have not been able to apply that principle in the United States is a great question for them, because it's eminently doable. But the president has to show some leadership. There's no question that there are broad failures for all of us to reflect on in this. But the president has to get out in front of it. It was Teddy Roosevelt in 1902 who led the charge. It was FDR in the 1930s who empowered the PCORA hearings in particular to really dig into what went wrong. And if you want to go back further, Tom, go to the 1830s. Look at Andrew Jackson against the Second Bank of the United States.
Tooth and
that
nail.
That was the absolute showdown between unelected, really nasty financial sector power and an elected president. And the president won just. And thank goodness we had a good 100 years because Andrew Jackson beat the Second Bank of the United States.
Indianapolis, Indiana, Aaron. You're on the air, Aaron.
How are you today?
Well, thanks. What do you know?
Hey, just wanted to make a quick comment. It seems to me that I have a finance MBA and am basically a student of finance. And one of the things that I've heard on today's call that I've heard often is the sense that financial risk and financial power and the idea of the oligarchy is all about perception. Yet what I have not seen in the last 100 years, and not since Andrew Jackson even, is a metric by which someone has set forth to say, here's how we're going to measure financial risk. I mean, a metric could even be attenuated to match certain size of certain financial institutions. So until we can actually, you can't actually regulate anything unless you can actually measure it first, correct?
Well, let's put that question to our professor. Simon Johnson, do you agree? Is there a paucity, a dearth of metrics for measuring financial risk?
It's a great question, and it's a very fair question. And if you can't measure it, you can't regulate and control. That's true. But we do have metrics. They haven't been applied. So, for example, let's look at the Regal-Neal Act of 1994. This is an act that substantially liberalized or almost completely liberalized interstate banking in the United States. That act specified that no single financial institution can have more than 10% of total retail deposits. In 1994, that seemed like a reasonable, sensible restriction. It's not an antitrust restriction. That's a very low market share at a national level. But it was a very sensible don't put all your eggs in one basket kind of restriction. Now, two observations on that. One is that rule was waived. The law still exists, but that rule was waived for Bank of America a couple of years ago. Not a good idea. Secondly, retail deposits, we've learned in the past 15 years, are not the right thing to target for that kind of hard size cap. You should be looking at the size of banks relative to the overall economy, relative to GDP. Because that is what's going to give you the indication of the cost when they fail and how much it's going to cost to sort of rescue the system and buffer the system against that failure. So you want to apply this very same principle that we've applied in the past. It was there in the 1994 Act. Apply it now, but apply it to bank assets relative to total GDP. And we have a proposal on the table with regard to what those numbers should be. Banks can choose whether they're a casino bank or a boring bank. Boring banks get a slightly higher cap. All of this would just push the financial system, individual institutions, back to where they were in terms of size in the early 1990s when the financial system worked just fine.
I want to talk about the Federal Reserve Bank Chief Ben Bernanke for a moment. You and your colleague Peter Boone have come out at the baseline scenario recommending that he not be confirmed, though the committee has set him up for Senate confirmation. It doesn't have it yet. Let's listen to – he spoke at the conference in Atlanta just the day before you did, and here's a little bit of tape of him, Simon, talking about the Fed's role in the economy, housing bubble bursting and recession, and what he learned.
The lesson I take from this experience is not that financial regulation and supervision are ineffective for controlling emerging risks, but that their execution must be better and smarter. The Federal Reserve is working not only to improve our ability to identify and correct problems in financial institutions, but also to move from an institution-by-institution supervisory approach to one that is attentive to the stability of the financial system as a whole.
Fed Chief Ben Bernanke talking there about better, smarter supervision. That sounds good, but you're against his reappointment. Why?
Well, I say this with some reluctance. Obviously, Bernanke is an esteemed academic. He did very good work on the Great Depression. And I also think that during the rescue phase of what happened after September 2008, he did a great job. But I'm afraid you have to face the facts here, Tom, unpleasant as they are. And that is that he was on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve from 2002. He became chairman of the Fed a couple of years before the crisis broke in earnest. He was there, and he had every opportunity to apply tougher regulation. The Fed had all the powers that were necessary. And I'm afraid that his thinking and his, if you like, the ideology that he bought into in and around and after Greenspan is a huge part of what got us into this. And if you go through, we withheld judgment and our view on whether he should be reconfirmed until after the hearings, until we'd seen all the things that he said, and he'd replied to all the questions in additional writing. And honestly, there's nothing, absolutely nothing, in what he has said that give us any basis for believing that next time will be different.
And the banks are listening to the same thing. And I guess as I read you, your main point is that you don't think he has credibility when he says that banks cannot, should not, must not count on being bailed out again. They don't necessarily believe him.
Well, they certainly don't believe it. I mean, you just need to go and look at what the technical place to look at this is what's called credit default swap spreads. This is where the market bets on probability of default for various kinds of financial instruments. Look at what these credit default swap spreads tell you the market believes after the Bernanke testimony about what will happen to Bank of America or Citigroup or any of the other, you know, big troubled financial institutions. The market is very clearly saying that they think there's going to be another bailout, as more bailouts, unlimited bailouts, as necessary. And that those expectations, of course, are self-fulfilling. If people believe that, they'll put money in, they will lend money to these massive institutions, they will get bigger, they will become even more dangerous, they will behave in a reckless fashion. This has to stop. And the Federal Reserve is not addressing this. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, is not speaking clearly and directly and honestly about too big to fail, the problems it poses, and how to deal with it.
Can you name
This is not going to a good place.
Can you name any individual, man, woman, who you could put in that Fed chief chair and the banks would say, oh my gosh, look who's there. There's no way that person will ever bail us out. Our behavior has to change.
Thomas Hoenig is the president of the Kansas City Fed. He's a member of the Federal Open Market Committee. He's a very experienced bank regulator and a serious thinker about monetary policy. He said in Atlanta this week that financial institutions that are too big to fail should be, I think the word he used was dismembered, which it works just fine for me. He understands exactly the point being made by Mr. Volcker. Putting Paul Volcker in, of course, would be very appealing, but he's 82, and I'm not sure he wants the job of being chairman of the Fed again. But you need somebody who's tough. You need somebody who's willing to take on the banks. And now is the moment, Tom, because the banks are coming back. The economy is recovering. Now's the time to clean it up. If you wait, it's going to be too late again.
A couple more quick calls. New York City, Mike. Mike, you're on the air with Simon Johnson.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
I want to know how these banks gave back this TARP money, and all of a sudden they're back to usual with their salaries and their bonuses when they're still completely under the Fed control. If the Fed walked away from the banking industry, mortgages and housing prices would, like, the bottom would fall out, and they're still going to the Fed window. They still have FDIC-backed loans, And even a person that has $1 in the bank, he's not getting interest because he's supporting the banks by not getting interest. The interest is going to the banks.
Mike, the time is short. Simon Johnson, what do you say to the observation from New York?
I think that exactly hits the nail on the head. All the strings that were attached to the bailout came with the money from Treasury, the so-called TARP money. But the real support that really saved the financial system, the big banks, was the Fed money, the Fed support, the discount window and lowering interest rates in the way they've done it, as the caller said. That is still there, but no strings were attached to that. And now you have this crazy situation where the banks made a massive amount of money because they could go back to taking risk again, and they can pay that out. Instead of saving that, rebuilding their capital, becoming safer, they're going to pay out half of it in February as bonuses, one way or another, Tom. Some of those bonuses will be disguised, but don't be deceived. It's going out as bonuses. That is very, very bad financial sector policy. It's terrible macroeconomic strategy. And it leads us to a very dangerous situation where the banks can really do it again, and they will do it again because that's their incentive. All the incentives here are messed up and in very bad shape, and we are going to, unless we change this, we are going to have another very big crisis.
Talk to your elected representatives. Okay, we've got that little duty to be done, but what about on the personal money side? We just got a minute and a half here, Simon. For people listening to this, you know, who are trying to save for a retirement one day, save for their family, for college, whatever, what are you recommending?
Well, I think everyone should take stock, and this is obviously a good time of year to do this. Take stock of where your money is and who you borrow from and what sort of terms of service you get. And if you... And, you know, I think you should. I'm not saying that you do anything on an altruistic basis. Just look at the fees you're paying for people to manage your money, or when you borrow money, and look at the alternatives out there. Because it is the case that in many communities there are either credit unions or smaller banks, savings banks, for example, that offer really good deals. There are small banks, for example, that refund your ATM fees when you use your card in other parts of the country, not on their machines, as long as you have direct deposit and sufficient money in the account and so on. Now, the terms of this, what's available is obviously going to differ according to your individual circumstances, but this is a great time to look at this because the financial sector has been ripping you off with fees for a long time. So think about moving your business away from some of the biggest banks towards where you can get on an individual basis a better deal.
Yes or no?
If you get a better deal, take it.
Is the government going to inflate its way out of the deficit jam it's in? Is that what the future holds?
We don't. That is the huge question, Tom. You know, cynical expert opinion is very, very much divided on that. We clearly have it running inflation tending policy, but because the economy has fallen so far, prices are not bouncing back or shooting up. We may get lucky this time. We may avoid inflation with this kind of rescue efforts. I would not count on that for the future.
Simon Johnson, look for his book, 13 Bankers, this spring. His blog is baselinescenario.com. Simon, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.